This episode of In the Thick is brought to you by 1-800-Flowers.
Have we passed immigration reform? No. Have we passed criminal justice reform? No. In the end, the people who end up making those decisions, well, that would be the white guys. Uno, dos, tres.
Hey, welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And, oh my God, In the Thick on the road. So with me right here in Washington, D.C. is Jimmy Williams. He's a former lobbyist who's worked on both sides of the aisle, and he's the host of my new favorite political podcast, Decode DC. Welcome to In the Thick, Jimmy.
So glad to be here.
We're going to start with Fox News. What are we going to choose from the panoply of the insanity of last week? Fox News, totally aware of the fact that Bill O'Reilly had settled 5 sexual harassment lawsuits for a total of $13 million. Finally, Fox News dismissed O'Reilly, arguably the cable news personality with the biggest reach in the country.
The no-spin zone is no more. Bill O'Reilly, the controversial face of Fox News for 21 years, was fired today by the network he helped put on the map.
And now, this week,
another lawsuit against the company, not about sexual harassment, but race.
New York Magazine is reporting that several black employees of Fox News are planning to join onto a racial discrimination lawsuit that's already been filed by 2 employees. So, Jimmy,
yeah,
do you think this might lead to a real shift at Fox News?
Look, it's a corporation. It's a publicly traded corporation that is closely held by a family. And the family wants to make money. And the power of money means they have to adapt. And if they don't adapt and they don't change the way they've been doing things, i.e. sexually harassing people, racial discrimination, et cetera, with a demographic in America that is changing rapidly. And what they have been spouting out heretofore has been largely anti-immigrant, has been largely anti anything but basically, I'm just going to say it, white people. So knowing that the demographics of the country are changing, they're going to have to change. And the brothers,
right, the brothers Murdoch,
they know this. They know this. And so that's why Roger Ailes is gone. That is why Bill O'Reilly is gone. But there is a culture at Fox News that has to change.
I'm trying to buy this. I am, Jimmy. There's a part of me that's like, look, were it not for the fact that like many, many advertisers pulled out, I don't know if they would have moved so quickly. I don't know. It seems to me that you're saying like the brothers Murdoch are going to professionalize Fox News. And if they want to appeal to this demographic, they're going to have to get a little bit more kind of POC sensitive and less stridently, you know, pro-white America. And I'm not so sure that I see that change coming.
Who are they replacing too? I mean, it's Bill O'Reilly, Tucker Carlson, another white male.
Maria's longtime friend. Yes, that's right. It's about the dollar. Let's just call it what it is. It's about the dollar. And if Fox News, which is the number one rated cable network in the country, if Fox News loses money, then they will change. If they don't, then they won't. And so here's the deal, advertisers, and here's the deal, left-wing America. If you don't like what Tucker Carlson has to say, you can do exactly to him what you is that they did to Bill O'Reilly. You can do exactly the same thing to Fox and Friends. You can do exactly the same thing to all the other shows that say the Sean Hannity. You can do it to him too. And advertisers care. They don't want their names and their brands associated with bad things. Now that the heat has been turned up, Fox News is sitting in a big, huge, massive oven, and people are turning the temperature up. And that temperature is not going to go down if they keep saying and doing the things that they've done in the past. If the culture at Fox News doesn't change, they have to change the culture. From HR to legal, I mean, these people have been in bed.
It's pretty bad, right?
Yeah, with a management that just didn't care, that it was normal to be sexually abused by your boss. That's just not okay. Look, I was a contributor for MSNBC for 5 or 6 years. At no point did anybody ever ask me to sleep with them. Not because it's the liberal network, but because that's just not a part of NBC's culture. And if it were, I wouldn't want to work for them.
So also this week,
the final sprint of the first 100 days.
Our sister podcast, Latino USA, which I anchor, we are doing a full 1-hour episode on the 100 days of Trump.
Right. And rather than going into how Trump is doing and all that, because everyone's talking about that. We're wondering this. Do you think it's weird that we make such a big deal about the 100 days? I mean, is it too small of a sample, or is it a meaningful way to judge how a president is doing?
I think it's a snapshot into the presidency. I think it's a snapshot into leadership. I think it is a way to look at, you've just been elected president of the United States. And so the question is, what can you get done? And what campaign promises can you make good on? And the answer to all of them so far is none. Julio's just laughing. I mean, that was not a criticism. He just hasn't done
them. He hasn't done anything. All right, go. Sorry, Maria. I'm sorry. I laughed too much.
I think you're right. It is a snapshot, Jimmy. Mm. But the other thing is that Donald Trump made a big deal about the first 100 days.
Sure he did. You make promise. Look, the American people elected him. He made the promises about the wall. He made the promises about deporting people. He made the promises about repealing and replacing Obamacare. The list is endless. But the bottom line is, if you don't keep your promises, then people think you're lying to them. And you cannot do that in politics, because people already think that all politicians are liars when they're not always liar.
But there's something that does feel qualitatively different about this president and the truth.
Well, because he's taken the truth and played, you know, footloose and fancy free with it for a very long time. But then, you know what? The Republicans, and I will give them the credit for doing this, spent a long time, 30 plus years, of making Hillary Clinton out to be the biggest liar in the Hillary and Bill Clinton into the biggest liars in the entire world. And the bottom line is, Hillary Clinton, as flawed as she was and as not flawed as she was, and no one has been more, I guess, ready to be president of the United States in their entire lives than Hillary Clinton. But the bottom line is, the American people think that the Clintons lie, because that's the story that's been told over and over and over again. With Trump, he comes from the outside. He is not a part of the mainstream. He's a financier. He is a Wall Street billionaire, although we don't know if he's a billionaire or not. He says this. Does he mean that? I mean, the bottom line is, with him, he is like Jell-O. You cannot pin him to the wall, despite the fact that he makes these pronouncements. If anyone actually thought that he was going to build a wall instantaneously, because, you know, by the way, building things takes time. Not to be too much of a smartass about it.
There's also the thing about laws.
Oh, well, then there's the Congress that appropriates the money, which, by the way, I just got off the phone with the leadership staff on the Hill, on the Senate side, and they're telling me, no, sorry, sucker, it ain't happening.
Ain't no wall going to be built.
That's right. They're going to pass a CR, give them a week.
That's going to be the new song.
That should be. But the bottom line is, Trump will be judged, by and large, on whether or not he keeps his promises. And if the people that elected him think that he let them down, guess what? They won't vote for him again.
All right, Jimmy, so today we're going to take a deep dive into that dark, mysterious D.C. institution, which is known as lobbying. It might be, in fact, the most powerful institution that most folks in the United States, well, they just don't know much about it.
Right, so let's start really simple here. What is a lobbyist, and how long have lobbyists had serious influence in Washington, D.C.?
Forever.
Seriously?
Yeah, I mean, listen—
Like founding fathers forever?
Yeah. I mean, there was no such thing. It wasn't called lobbying, because that was not the term that existed at that time. But there were people that would come before the government and say, listen, this is our problem. You know, back then, to be honest with you, any normal citizen could come up to their politician, their elected politician, and say what they want, which, by the way, is lobbying.
You're basically saying, if you go into Congress or you go to see your Congress or senator, you're lobbying, and go ahead and own that.
And by the way, you should, because it's in the First Amendment.
You should be lobbying.
It says you have the right to redress your government for your grievances. It's in the First Amendment of the Constitution. There, I mean, boom, it's on like lambskin. So, but good God, own that stuff, folks.
The term lobbyist, does that come from waiting in a lot? Like, where does it come from, and what?
Yeah, so it loosely comes from the idea that there's a hotel here in Washington, D.C. called the Willard. And powerful businessmen back then, sadly it wasn't business women, but business. If more women were in lobbying, we'd be in a better place. But the bottom line is, men would wait in the lobby of the Willard, which is where politicians would stay, and they would, you know, that's where the name comes from.
So kind of transactional, right? Influence. influence, essentially.
Yeah.
So does lobbying exist in other countries, too?
Oh, sure. I don't know of any other country that it doesn't exist in, although it exists in different forms. I don't know about the Magna Carta and if it's in them. I couldn't tell you if it is or isn't. But I'm pretty sure that people lobby the English Parliament. I have no doubt that they do. The House of Lords, right?
So now let's talk about some of the effects of lobbying.
Yeah.
And one example in particular. ProPublica recently reported that filing income taxes could be way easier than it is now. The government could easily send us all forms that are filled out with our incomes and deductions, and all we'd need to do is sign them.
And according to ProPublica, and I had a heart attack when I was reading all about this, the reason why we still have these really complicated tax forms, it's because of lobbying by Intuit, which owns H&R Block and TurboTax, and they're basically lobbying against making the filing of taxes easy.
That's how you keep your businesses going. All due disclosure, when I was a lobbyist at Ogilvy Government Relations, Intuit was a client of ours, and I worked on these issues.
And spoken like a true lobbyist. He totally disclosed. This is awesome.
I disclose. I'm also openly gay. Just so, and you know, and I own a dog, and I like to work in my garden. So just FYI, these are all things that people know about me.
Those things we applaud for.
Right.
For,
yeah. Just not being a former lobbyist. But look, you know, the thing that I worked on with them was the idea of how you could do it online, how you could file your taxes online. I did not work on stopping people from being able to file their taxes in less traditional ways. Look, I get why they do it. I think it's wrong. I mean, you can go on to the IRS, go to IRS.gov, try to do your online file. If you make $64,000 or something like that or more a year, you can't do it online. You have to actually mail in the physical thing via snail mail, which is crazy that you can't do that.
It's actually their interests, right? The corporate interests that are pushing the agenda. For example, when in the immigration issue, when you had private prison companies.
Sure.
Pressing for more detentions, mm-hmm. Writing policy papers, because ultimately that's going to mean more money for them.
Yeah.
So
the almighty dollars at work.
Right. So,
yes.
So when people say, well, how do we even fight against this? How do we? And I mean, that would basically be killing the job that allowed you to live for and have probably a nice life.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Listen, I mean, it was a fantastic life. It was otherworldly. But the mighty dollar that drives these corporations and these, and by the way, and labor unions, let's be completely and totally honest here.
It's, so lobbying on the left and the right.
Yeah,
let's
be really honest here that the idea of lobbying is not a left-right issue. It is an American issue. It is a political issue. And so as long as someone has a moneyed interest before the Congress that the Congress can either help them with or screw them with, lobbyists are going to continue to exist. The problem is that the money that is now changing hands between lobbyists and lawmakers is so disgustingly high and gross that's what it all boils down to. If you don't raise enough money, you don't get the meetings, you don't get to have the face-to-face time with these members of Congress. The reason I left lobbying was because I just got tired of raising money for a bunch of politicians. You know, they didn't give a damn what my policy was. They didn't care that Intuit or NASCAR, who was a former client of mine, they didn't care what they wanted. They wanted to know how much money I was going to raise. And that was the policy, right? That to me was the problem.
Here I am listening to you. I know you're living a new life, living off the dream of being a podcast host and just living off the high hog of that.
Yes. A paltry journalist. Yes, indeed. Yes.
But how do you change all that? How do you change what you're saying?
Well, the Supreme Court has made it clear also that the First Amendment allows that they say that money is speech. Until you change that by passing a constitutional amendment saying that money is not speech, then that means that campaign finance laws, all these things that the Congress passes, that they're all going to be struck down by the high court. And everyone loves Justice Kennedy, Anthony Kennedy, the swing justice, the moderate justice. And if you go back and you look at every one of the campaign finance cases, what's the one thing that Justice Kennedy says? Money is speech. So he's great on gay marriage. He's great on lots of things. But he's also really, really bad on this issue of money and speech. And he believes that money is speech. And until the Congress passes a constitutional amendment and the states ratify it, then money is speech. And that means you're going to be able to buy and sell your way into any office in America, from the Congress and the White House all the way down to the mayor's office.
So is there a context in which the lobbying, you know, from the First Amendment all the way down to big corporations, can it be seen as a good thing?
Yeah, I do. Because, again, I think you have the right to scream and bitch and complain at your government or say thank you. I think you have the right to say thank you. And that's lobbying as well. And so, you know, if lobbyists gave us good things like SCHIP, you know, state children's health insurance plans, lobbyists gave us things like the EITC, the earned individual tax credit. Lobbyists gave us college tuition tax credit. These are all things that lobbyists came up with, and these are things that help middle America and low-income America. You know, lobbyists now lobby on behalf of Medicare and Medicaid, and then there are plenty of lobbyists who lobby on the other side saying, I want to privatize it. So lobbyists do good work. And by the way, everyone has a lobbyist. The nuns have a lobbyist. The snack food vendors have lobbyists.
Wait, nuns?
Did you say nuns have a lobbyist? What's the nuns' lobbyist?
Yes, they do. It's called the Roman Catholic Church. They indeed do have a lobbyist. Don't think for a millisecond that the church does not lobby.
I want to be clear. I want us to all have a picture in our minds that there is an office in Washington, D.C. that is the Vatican office of lobbyists?
No, I don't think it's called the Vatican office, but there, I mean, I'm
it's
sure.
Centro Católico de Lobistas?
Talia, what did she just call me? She said something very mean,
good.
I think, to me.
She loves you. She loves you, Jimmy. She totally loves you.
Yeah, no, I mean, like Catholic Charities. Catholic Charities it's a not-for-profit, but they can lobby. You know, anybody can lobby. That's my point here. Anybody can do this. The Congress gets involved in these issues, as they should. It's Congress's job. And here's the other thing I figured out, both as a staffer and as a lobbyist. And I spend an equal amount of time doing both. There almost is always two sides to every argument. And both can be valid. Okay? It is never black and white when it comes to policy and politics. You know, people run around saying, well, if I do this, that's going to help my guy. But if you do that, it's going to hurt that my constituents in Nebraska or North Dakota or whatever it is. You know, we run around this whole thing about Trump's going to bring coal jobs back. The coal lobby out there is going around saying, no, we don't want solar. We don't want wind. We don't want this renewable, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And then Donald Trump says, I agree with you. I'm going to bring those coal jobs back. Right. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, guess who would benefit from having solar and wind? Well, California would benefit from that. Utah would benefit from that. Big, flat, wide open spaces would benefit from that. So if you help out coal, you're going to hurt these guys. And the senator from Utah is not going to like that versus the senator from California versus the senator from West Virginia. People love sausage.
I do.
If you saw how sausage was actually made in a butcher or a meat factory, you would vomit instantaneously.
Oh, thanks, Jimmy.
It is not pretty.
That's beautiful.
Sorry about that, Leo. but it's the same with politics. It's messy, it's ugly, it's dirty, but it's also called democracy, folks.
Hey, this is Julio. And in case you missed last week's episode, I'm one awful son. Mother's Day is less than a month away, and you see, I haven't gotten my mom's any flowers in over 20 years. But this year, it's all going to be different because 1-800-Flowers is here to help. I could just go ahead and order the flowers, but I need to make sure they're perfect. So I asked two of my Futuro Media friends if they had any advice on picking the right flowers.
Really? I think the message is just do it.
Should I not wait for Mother's Day is what you're saying?
You should not wait for Mother's Day. You should do it occasionally, whenever you feel like it.
That's Jeannie Montalvo. And she told me straight up, why are you waiting until Mother's Day to get flowers? Get them now. You don't need a special occasion.
It's even better when it's like a random, hey, I was walking home and I picked up these flowers. And I think they're great.
And Jeannie's not the only one telling me this. Here's what In the Thick senior editor Nadia Raymond told me about my wishy-washiness.
Get an orchid. Go all out, because they're like exotic and weird and they look muy, muy, like, expensive.
Okay. I seriously need to just order the flowers. And 1-800-Flowers is the perfect place to do it. They have a vast selection of beautiful bouquets and arrangements that you can give the important people in your life. And they start at just $29.99. So take it from Jeannie and Nadia. Any day is a great day to get flowers. To get beautiful bouquets starting from just $29.99, go to 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, and enter code ITT. That's 1-800-Flowers.com. Don't forget to click the radio icon and enter code ITT. Order them today. And if you're a fan of In the Thick, try our sister podcast, Latino USA. This week, Maria visits the Iowa district of the controversial anti-immigrant congressman, Steve King, and finds out a few things. Number one, it's full of immigrants. And number two, it's more complicated than you might think. Subscribe to Latino USA, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to In the Thick. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and with me is my co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela. And we're joined by Jimmy Williams, who's a former lobbyist and the host of Decode DC. And I'm with him in the studio in Washington, D.C. Let's get right back to our conversation. I'm really excited to be asking this question.
Okay. I'm not sure excited I would be to answer it, but go ahead.
Well, as you know, In the Thick is a show that basically looks at things from a POC perspective, a people of color perspective.
Yeah.
But not only, but we love to raise these questions. So is lobbying mostly a white industry? Are there like a lot of lobbyists working on issues related to POC?
The lobbying industry reflects what Congress and the staff look like. I mean, if you look at the Hill staff, I'd say it looks a lot like America.
The Hill staff, not the elected.
That's who becomes.
Not the elected.
No. Get rid of the electeds. Get rid of those idiots. I'm talking about the Hill staff that actually make the damn place run.
Okay, sorry. Yes. I was thinking about the people that we elect.
Not the white guys.
Okay.
The people that run the white guys. Right. Come on.
All right. I'm snapping right there. That's hilarious. I love that. It's true.
It's totally true. You know, I mean, listen, I think the Hill staff looks a lot like America. And most of them end up either going to law school or medical school or becoming lobbyists or an advocates of some sort. And by the way, when someone says they're an advocate for something, that means they're a lobbyist, FYI. That's code. That means you're a lobbyist. But that, I mean, I can't, when I think back to my lobbying days, I'll tell you the one person I hung out with the most was my friend Priya. I won't say her last name. Priya is American Indian and we'd hang out in the House Financial Services Committee and the Senate Banking Committee every single day doing our deal, you know, going to hearings, going to markups. And there were white guys in the room, but there were a lot of people of color in that room and on the lobbying side and on the Hill staff side.
Okay, so if we've established the fact that it's diverse, right? Let's go with that premise.
Sure.
But does that lead to power? You know, you can have a diverse set of people in the staff, and you can have lobbyists having drinks and networking and everything. But has that led to policies that directly impact communities of color? And we'll talk about recent years, just the last couple of years, some examples. I mean, whether it's immigration or police reform or whatever, has that lobbying led to sort of that change?
Why don't I ask the question back to you this way? Have we passed immigration reform? No. Have we passed criminal justice reform? No. Have we passed? The answer is no. It hasn't, because in the end, the people who end up making those decisions, well, that would be the white guys.
So we kind of circled around to what we were trying to ask for Maria's questioning, which is exactly, I think, the perception that's out there that a lot of these issues, even though they're on the forefront of communities of color, aren't really making the bill.
Basically, what Jimmy has just reaffirmed, which is that there is structural racism.
Oh, sure. It's institutional racism.
Institutional racism. Yeah. So
that doesn't mean that white people can't sympathize or empathize, for that matter.
Or create policy.
Absolutely, of course not.
We've seen that in action. We know that.
But think about the Gang of 14. Was it the Gang of 14 or the Gang of 16 that was ready to do immigration reform?
Gang of 8.
Gang of 8.
Gang of 14.
How many of them were people of color?
The white Cubans.
Right. The white Cubans.
Yeah. Okay. But that's it. Everybody else was just lily white like me. Trying to get it done.
So,
who was the president?
Barack Obama.
And so a black guy who, as I remind people, including my mother, he's also half white.
Right.
People are like, oh, he's black. No, he's half white too. But the bottom line is, if you had a black president and a Congress that kind of looks like America, sort of a little teeny bit, well, they couldn't get it done. I mean, that just shows you right there that there is an institutional problem here. And And I would suggest that it all boils down to the amount of money out there that people are throwing around at the issues and scapegoating and making people fearful for things.
Yeah, you know, you're saying on the one hand, look, every citizen can lobby and you should. And I kind of love that, right?
Yeah.
But you're also saying the money is kind of untouchable. It's huge. It may not, you know, it's in the power of mostly non-people of color hands. Mm-hmm. So what, we just have to let this play out? There's nothing that we can do in terms of changing this?
I think, you know what I'd love to see? I'd love to see people of color run for office at every level. I would love for people of color to go to town halls and say...
And LGBTQ folks,
absolutely.
Of course, and Muslim folks.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. Right. Show up at town halls. The bottom line is, there's the one thing that a member of Congress hates more, that was more fearful than anything in the world, is not being reelected. So you know what? Let them know that you're not going to reelect them. Vote against them. Tell them that you're going to vote against them. Get your family to tell them that they're going to vote against them. Run against them.
I'm going to pivot back to this. I do believe that people who voted for Donald Trump really wanted to believe when he said, I'm going to drain the swamp of lobbyists and all that money and influence. I believe that they wanted to do that. So what about that promise, Jimmy? Did he drain the swamp? I hate that
term.
There's
no such thing as draining the swamp. You can't drain the swamp. Because that's a ridiculous notion. Hillary Clinton got excoriated for giving, you know, speeches to Goldman Sachs. And what does Donald Trump do? He goes and hires half of Goldman Sachs to run his government. The sad part is, if you ask most Americans what Goldman Sachs is, they'd say, it's a bank, I think, maybe. I'm not really sure. Yeah, it's a bank. Are you kidding? Come on. And so it's a financial services holding company, actually, which is
thank you for that. We appreciate
it's
that.
It's very important. But the bottom line is that this idea that you're going to drain the swamp until you ban the money, what feeds the swamp is money. And the swamp is going to continue to be what it is. And people should stop demonizing lobbyists, because lobbyists are it's in the First Amendment. So stop that. Decry the money. Get rid of the money, and then you can let politicians go back to doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is actually representing the people that they are elected to represent. Now, there's a problem with that, and that is that you have on the House side, you have gerrymandered districts. Now, that is not the only problem. There's another problem called self-sorting. Basically, you have people that white people live together. And black people live together, and Hispanic people live together, and they want to live in those communities because that's where they feel like they should live, right? Okay, fine. So people sort themselves, into their own communities. And so then politicians on the state level then go and redraw those district lines, saying, well, it's very convenient that all the Hispanics live in this area. We'll put them over here. Or we'll take 3% of them and put them in that lily white district so that that guy's never going to be in trouble and he's going to get reelected, et cetera. And then are they represented by their lily white guy? The answer is no, because 97% of the district's white. Why would you even care about 3% of your district? Because they don't look like you.
Right.
It's 3%. They could all vote against you and it doesn't matter. So gerrymandering plus self-sorting is a problem, and that's something that Democrats absolutely dropped the ball on in 2010. They paid no attention to it. And there's a reason why the Democrats are not going to win the House back in 2018 unless Donald Trump is sitting at 25% and their impeachment proceedings against him. And even then, I doubt that the Democrats would take the House back because those districts are just hardly winnable for Democrats. So I don't know how you fix it.
So let's move on to our final segment, Mic Drop. This is a segment where guests get to choose from a list of options for their final words. You say your piece, and then you drop the mic.
All right, so we have five options to choose from, Jimmy. Fantasy CNN, What's Missing, Tough Questions, Mea Culpa, or Side Eye. So what's it going to be, Jimmy?
Fantasy CNN. I was thinking about this on the drive-in this morning. Fantasy CNN. And what I would like, or I should probably say Fantasy MSNBC. Right? What I'd really like to do is, I've had this idea for a long time, and this wouldn't necessarily be a show. It'd be like a pre-taped video that you do, a series with politicians, and you go into their home, or they come to your home, or you go to a neutral place, and you cook with them. You're laughing, right? You're like, you idiot. Why would you ever want to do that?
The reason why I'm laughing is because I am friends with a let's just call him a white nationalist from Atlanta.
Who, when, I'm not.
Well, what? When, yeah, I'm friends with a lot of people. And when he said, you know what? Let's go into my kitchen and cook some shrimp and grits. And I was like, all right, I think it's a great idea.
Listen, politicians, as inhuman and as unhuman and as inhumane as they are, they're actually still humans. Mm. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not doing this with Steve King, okay? That ain't happening. The congressman from Iowa, who I think is a very awful person. But, and I don't really like Ted Cruz, but I wouldn't mind sitting down and like maybe cooking with Ted Cruz.
Have a little ropa vieja.
Here's why. I want to know, I mean, this guy's a husband. He's a father. And there's a human side to Ted Cruz. There has to be as human. I've actually eaten dinner with Ted Cruz back when he was in law school.
So there is an amiable side to Ted Cruz?
There wasn't really that night, but I can tell you that it was a group dinner party. It was a group dinner party. But I mean, the point here is that, you know, if I could fashion this, politicians just need to get outside of the camera and be around other politicians and being in those halls of power and those halls of Congress, put them in a place where they actually have to chop onions and do like normal people do every single day when they go home, and see if there is a human side to them, if there's a compassionate side to them. I just think we could learn a hell of a lot about politicians by taking them out of their political world and putting them in a regular human world.
And get great recipes too. Like, I'm sure Ted Cruz has ropa vieja, tostones.
Dude, I'm not so convinced.
He said it with Halpern.
Yeah, I'm not so convinced that these guys would have very good recipes. But
I'll bring the recipes and I'll bring the bourbon. How about that? Right. Okay, that's fine. Yeah.
But I do like the sense of Jimmy, of you kind of saying, look, let's try and find some humanity and some compassion, because I'm all about that. All right, so Julio, what's your mic drop?
My mic drop is what's missing. And to bring it down to the immigrants' rights community, the evolution of what are these young dreamers doing in the Trump era, right? Because they were actually some of the most vocal voices against Barack Obama when it comes to deportations. But now here they are in the Trump era and they're trying to still get their message across as to, like, for example, the recent case of Juan Manuel Montes, who was a 23-year-old DACA recipient who was deported to Mexico. And there's a lawsuit involving it. And I'm had a conversation with Grace Martinez of United We Dream. And the thing that when I asked her straight up, I said, how is the undocumented immigrants rights movement, the youth movement, evolving now during Trump? And she said something really interesting to me that really stuck with me about how this issue of deportation and detention needs to actually become more of a racial issue in the same instance of something like Black Lives Matter, and that these conversations need to go beyond just the dreamer, the 23-year-old valedictorian who came from Mexico, and actually start being more inclusive of other voices, particularly Black voices, Black Caribbean voices, Black African voices, where this whole notion that these young undocumented immigrants are just Latin American. You know, the fastest growing ones, Maria, you say it all the time, Asian Americans, people from Africa and places like that. And I think that was a really interesting observation that I just noticed in the last week, sort of the evolution of the immigrants' rights community. So, Maria, what do you have?
Well, you kind of go from there, what you raised, Julio, which is kind of understanding a complexity. And I'm looking at what I heard when I was at an airport recently last week.
Oh, dear.
Yes. So last week
side eye.
Was
here's a side eye. I feel a side eye coming.
This was a total side eye. I did do an epic travel last week. Started in Arlington, Texas, outside of Dallas, Fort Worth, Cincinnati, and then of course in Kentucky because I landed in Kentucky, Moline, Illinois, Northern Illinois, Davenport, Iowa. That's where I was. And in one of those places, I don't remember which airport I was in, but I was in an airport waiting for. Oh, I know. It was O'Hare, of course.
Of course it was O'Hare,
and
yeah.
Let's see. What airline? I can't remember. But, you know, that was when I was watching CNN. And an anchor.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I mean, I used to work at CNN. So I have a soft spot for CNN. I do. And an anchor on the air actually said something to the effect of asking in a serious panel question about Judge Curiel having to now listen to the case of the deported dreamer.
Right.
And she actually asked seriously whether or not this, I know the word Mexican came up there, and should he recuse himself from this case? Should he recuse himself?
This is an anchor?
This is an anchor.
Yeah,
and
I did.
I tweeted out. I hate to do this to fellow journalists because I try to start from a place of respect. But I was like, that is a stupid question, and it was so insulting to me that this is where we've gotten to, where now anchors, polished supposedly anchors, are asking ridiculous questions that are baseless, and that to me is called poisoning the swamp. Jimmy Williams, former lobbyist and the host of Deco DC. Thank you so much for joining Julio and me on In the Thick.
This has been fantastic. Thank you very much.
I am Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And remember, please go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us, because it takes you a second, but it actually really helps us to find new listeners, which I know you want us to do. You can also follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In The Thick Show. You can like us on Facebook and, of course, tell your family and friends to listen. Our producer is Noam Hassenfeld. Our senior editor is Nadia Raymond. Our theme music is Comencemos by Jungle Fire. Some of our music is composed by Noam, and the other music that you heard is courtesy of Nacional, Kept, and ZZK Records. We'll see you next time on In The Thick. Thanks for listening. Adios.
Nos vemos.
We're going to talk about making the sausage.